The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 12th of August 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme:
Government reaffirms its commitment to maintain law and order, including protecting the fundamental rights of the general public.
Vice President Mohamed Julde Jallo of Sierra Leone declares a nationwide curfew as the government appeals for calm after days of violent protests. We'll have the latest from Freetown. Then we're in Ukraine as the United Nations calls for a demilitarized zone around Europe's largest nuclear plant, as reports of fighting continue between Russian and Ukrainian forces. Also ahead,
tonight there are new details about the unprecedented FBI search of former President Donald Trump's Florida home. What we're learning.
That's our line. We will have this week's What We Learned. All that, plus the film critic Karen Krasanovich is here to unpack the latest box office news. That's all ahead in the next 30 minutes right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has warned of potentially catastrophic consequences should fighting continue in the vicinity of Ukraine's nuclear power plant near Zaporizhia. It is Europe's largest such facility and was seized by Russian troops early in Russia's current assault on Ukraine, since when Russia has been using the plant as a base for its artillery, as if daring Ukraine to risk shooting back. The Ukrainian state nuclear energy company Energoatom said the area around the plant, Europe's largest nuclear facility, was struck at least five times yesterday. I'm joined with more by Lada Roslitsky, founder of Black Trident, a defense and security consulting group in Ukraine. Lada, first of all, nuclear plants are supposed to be built to withstand most things. I'm not sure how far they factor incoming artillery into those plans. Do we know how well protected this plant is?
Well, unfortunately, the nuclear plants all over Ukraine, and there are a number of them, have been not kept up in a very good condition since the fall of the Soviet Union. So they were already posing a little bit of an environmental risk, and the European Union was working closely with Ukraine to upgrade the security. So the situation is even made worse by the condition that they were in before Russia invaded Ukraine.
There is, as always in conflict, a great deal of claim and counterclaim about what is actually going on at this particular nuclear plant. Do we know for sure how serious the fighting around it has been?
Well, it started on the 3rd of March when Russia attacked first with the artillery projectiles and bombing the building number one. And they took over, hijacked the people who work there. The personnel have been tortured. There are reports of this. And this has been going on for 6 months. And lately, the situation is starting to become much more heated, particularly by the presence of Rosatom, which is now acting, in effect, as a transnational organized criminal group, which is trying to hijack this station and shift it over to feed Crimea. And the fact that it is surrounded, it is mined, it is surrounded by Russian forces, is just appalling. And the call for demilitarization must be heeded. And perhaps it is worthwhile considering also providing a demilitarized zone in the Rivne, Khmelnytsky, South Ukraine nuclear power plant areas as well.
Well, let's talk a bit about this idea of some sort of demilitarized zone around this and other nuclear plants. One thing that strikes me as interesting about it is that China, as well as the United States, is calling for UN experts to at least go and visit Zaporizhia. If China is getting behind this, does that mean Russia might be more inclined to listen?
Well, Russia has to listen because it is threatening the security of the entire planet. And China chiming in is a positive sign. That having been said, we have to also consider that the International Atomic Energy Association has many, many Russians working inside of it. So while we are going to be creating a committee or a commission that should be coming there, the selection must be extremely, the selection of the professionals who would be going must be extremely tight. Security checks must be done. We've seen what happened with Russian infiltration in the special monitoring mission of the OSCE, still dating back from the 2014. So we have to pull lessons learned and really be strict with who will be attending and really push Russia to not make us wait longer. Now, the Russians have said that they will allow some sort of access by the end of this month. That's quite some time away, and attention needs to be paid to what are they doing in the coming weeks internally. What are the Rosatom operatives inside of the factory doing with this computer system that they have brought in, and really stand together united for demilitarization and inspection?
Is it being too optimistic or naive by half to hope that Russian self-interest might contribute to some sort of resolution here? Because I mean, Russia doesn't need telling twice. It can remember back as far as Chernobyl in 1986. I'm sure that a nuclear disaster in Ukraine is by definition also a disaster for Russia.
Exactly. And also the, far beyond Russia, and unfortunately into Europe and in towards the Middle East. So this is where we can call that bluff and really understand that Russia is becoming using this station as a terrorist that wants something. And we cannot heed to what Russia is demanding, because if we do, we will allow them to get away with the genocide that they are committing in Ukraine. And it will empower Rosatom's behavior across the planet. We should be keeping an eye out on Bangladesh and Turkey as well.
And just finally, about the war more broadly, the headline event this week has been this, well, apparent extraordinary raid on this Russian airbase deep within Crimea. Do we know any more about that?
Well, we know that the number of aircrafts that have been destroyed is higher than 9. Who is behind it exactly has not been made public. The fact that the Russian Federation is denying that it had anything to do with external forces is also indicative of their nervousness to actually show how vulnerable they are to the population in Crimea, which we see currently a mini exodus occurring from the Autonomous Republic of Crimea.
Lada Ruslitsky in Ukraine, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Paige Reynolds with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Former US President Donald Trump will not oppose the release of the warrant that let FBI agents search his Mar-a-Lago home earlier this week. The Department of Justice made a rare request to a Florida court to unseal the warrant, which could mean the documents will be made available to the public. Mr. Trump continues to claim the search was unnecessary and politically motivated. Thousands of Brazilians have taken to the streets in several cities across the country in protest of President Jair Bolsonaro. Demonstrators fear the far-right leader will try to stay in power if he loses the October presidential election and won't respect the outcome of the vote. Bolsonaro has repeatedly attempted to discredit Brazil's voting system. And the French cartoonist Jean-Jacques Sempé, who won international acclaim with his covers for the New Yorker magazine, has died at the age of 89. He illustrated the much-loved series of French children's books, Le Petit Nicolas, and with over 100 cover drawings under his belt, Sempé had made more New Yorker magazine covers than any other artist. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Paige. Freetown has been under curfew much of this week following violent protests. At least 27 people have been reported killed, including 6 police officers. The protests have been animated by a range of grievances among Sierra Leone's people, which boil down to a combination of dramatically rising prices and non-rising wages. Sierra Leone's president, Julius Maada Bio, who was out of the country when the protests began, has returned and is inveighing grimly against what he has described as acts of terrorism stirred up by overseas agitators. Well, I'm joined with more on this from Freetown by the journalist Umaru Fofana. Umaru, first of all, bring us up to date. How does Freetown feel this lunchtime?
Well, it's much calmer. The shops have started reopening. A good number of them are open. I've driven through the city centre and parts of the west of Freetown. It's much, much calmer. Some shops remain firmly shut for fear of the unknown. The police are still visible, and the government has invoked what is known here as MACP. That's a military aid to civil power when the soldiers are deployed alongside the police to shore up state security. I've also driven to the east end of Freetown, which was the real epicenter of the Wednesday protests and skirmishes, and it's all clear. Some tires were burning up to yesterday, but then the streets have all been cleared up now. And it's much calmer today, even if people are still anxious, not sure what may happen in the next day or two.
The violence was obviously serious. 27 people have been reported killed. But was it widespread or was it concentrated in one particular area?
Well, it was concentrated in areas that are opposition heartlands, so to speak. Areas in the north of the country as well as in parts of the capital, Freetown, which election in, election out, would vote for the opposition All People's Congress Party. So those were the areas that had the protests. But it had been building up. In the days leading up to it, there had been threats that there would be protests, and they had called on people to come out. But the dichotomy of Sierra Leonean politics is such that those areas where the ruling party has its strongholds were quite quiet. Nothing happened there. Life was normal. And those areas where the opposition has its stronghold were the areas where, you know, people came out and protested. So in that regard, it could be referred to as having happened in the north of the country as well as in parts of the western area, which is where the capital is. And even in the capital, it's all concentrated in the east, which again is dominated by opposition supporters.
It's often the case with protests like this that it's large-scale discontent that's built up for a while that gets ignited by a particular thing. Was that what happened here? Is it possible to identify something that set it off?
Well, it's very obvious that in the last few weeks and months, people have been complaining about the current economic situation. Prices of essential commodities have been soaring. Virtually every other day you go to the markets, the prices have increased. So clearly, there have been all those dissents in the last few weeks and months. But also the increase in the price of petroleum products, for which the government has cited the situation in Ukraine. But people, once the price of petrol goes up, it affects virtually every other essential commodity. So yes, clearly, there had been that discontent building up. But then, from the protests and the protesters, some of whom carried banners or posters or flyers, virtually every placard that I saw had to do with calling for the president to go. You didn't see anything having to do with, like, say, there is economic hardship, prices must come down. I didn't see any of those, not in the videos that circulated on social media, not on the placards that I saw myself, some of the protesters carrying, which has led the government to say that it was all politically motivated, and the government has blamed it on the main opposition party. The party, though, has come out and vehemently denied any links with the protesters, saying that they denounce violence in all its forms, and they feel that if for any reason they should come to power, it should be through the ballot box.
The president, as I mentioned in the introduction, has also been blaming what he appears to think is a network of overseas agitators causing trouble for him. Does anybody believe that, or is that him playing to his own supporters?
Oh, absolutely. There has been a particular Sierra Leonean in somewhere in Europe who for the last year or two has been sending what many here regard as incendiary messages. He does videos and even audios and sends them through the social media platforms that exist here. And consistently, he's instructed or even incited people to come out and demonstrate. He did it, I think, 2 years ago, which, by coincidence or not, led to an attempted prison break, which led to wanton loss of life again there. A lot of the prisoners were gunned down because of what the government said, that it was their attempt to kill some of the prison warders. And I think at least one of the prison warders was killed, and it led to serious violence. He also had issued some audios asking people across to protest against the state, and it led to protest again in a fishing community just outside Freetown. And again, before witnessing this event, he had sent audio messages from Europe asking for people to come out and surround the office of the president. So yes, there has been some influence emanating from those social media messages coming in from at least one individual, but also certainly from some other people somewhere in Europe who are Sierra Leoneans.
So beyond that, though, has there been any indication from the government that they have any ideas about how to address those grievances that you mentioned, specifically the spike in petrol costs, which, as you correctly point out, does end up causing a spike in the price of pretty much everything else?
I mean, the government has consistently said that it's beyond its control. They've cited the war, you know, in Ukraine as a reason for the increase in the price of petroleum products, which they say is beyond their control. They've cited COVID, which had wreaked havoc before the events of Ukraine, saying that all of those external factors influenced the increase in the price of petroleum products. But then critics here have argued that, yes, you are elected to deal with these situations, find ways of mitigating the impact on the people of Sierra Leone. The government has argued that it has introduced some measures, safety net, projects, which it says, have affected or has impacted people, particularly low-income earners or even the unemployed, the disabled. Yes, they have a project that they call the MUNAFA project, which is a World Bank-funded project, under which the government has doled out some money to some deprived communities. But beyond that, they've simply not really addressed the core issues in terms of coming out with solutions to mitigate the impact of all of these things on the populace, blaming it entirely on external factors. But it has to be said also that I interviewed, for example, the main opposition leader who was the presidential candidate in the elections of 2015 and who is likely going to be the presidential candidate again next year's elections. I've asked him if he was president, what he would do. And I asked him three times. He didn't come up with any ideas as to what he would have done if he was president of Sierra Leone. So that's the situation Sierra Leoneans find themselves in. The government doesn't seem to have the answers to deal with it, and there doesn't seem to be any alternative, you know, person or party coming up with any policies to mitigate these problems.
Umaru Fofana in Freetown, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And you're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24, and it is time now for our weekly reflection on the extent to which the last 7 days have enlarged our understanding of this world at this time. We learned this week that demanding that the FBI start feeling the collars of allegedly malfeasant politicians...
So crooked Hillary, crooked that you should lock her up, I'll tell you.
...is all fun and games until the feds turn up on the doorstep of your ghastly Florida gin palace equipped with a warrant and a few questions pertaining to classified material that you may have trousered before your famously tiny fingers were prized from the Oval Office doorframe.
Tonight, there are new details about the unprecedented FBI search of former President Donald Trump's Florida home. What we're learning...
Hey, that's our catchphrase. We also learned that a good many senior figures in Donald Trump's Republican Party, which once upon a time was ostentatiously keen on law and order, were now all aboard the defund the police bandwagon.
This is a wake-up call for those in Congress to be able to use the tools at their disposal to defund the FBI
And we learned, or really in this instance supposed, that Trump must be absolutely furious with whichever idiot handpicked the current FBI director, Christopher Wray.
We have breaking news from the White House where President Trump has found a replacement for fired FBI director James Comey. The president tweeted minutes ago, "I will be nominating Christopher A. Wray, a man of impeccable credentials, to be the new director."
You can't get the staff. And hell itself can hath little fury like Trump's rage at whichever clown signed off on the amendment to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which made the mishandling of classified documents a felony. This became law in, let's see, 2018, when the president, let's see now, was... We further learned that Trump was having one of those weeks where you just can't get a lot of golf played. Come on, where's our golf noise? We learned that Trump was also obliged to present himself to New York State Attorney General Letitia James, who had notes about the conduct of certain aspects of the Trump Organization's business. Trump, we learned, availed himself repeatedly of the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, which, broadly speaking, entitles a citizen to keep their yap shut if they feel that opening it might drop them in the
soup.
But we learned that those upstanding Americans who believe that pleading the Fifth Amendment is a shabby ruse employed only by the obviously guilty do have one prominent ally.
The mob takes the Fifth. If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?
When you have your staff taking the Fifth Amendment, taking the Fifth so they're not prosecuted, when you have the man that set up the illegal server taking the Fifth, I think it's disgraceful.
Have you seen what's going on in front of Congress? Fifth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Fifth Amendment. Horrible. Horrible.
Do we have a sizzling sausage sort of effect somewhere? Outstanding. Because in semi-related news, and at least in what seems like kind of a metaphor for 21st century American conservatism generally, we learned that the appetite of 21st century American conservatives for getting performatively enraged about things which could not possibly matter less is very nearly as large as the appetite of 21st century American conservatives for the pitifully obvious grift of a career con man. Champagne satire there. We learned that the popular US restaurant chain Cracker Barrel, which makes much of its good old-fashioned down-home southern country shtick, had added to its menus a vegan sausage. You know it. Actually, remember that ironically aghast chorus about that MP Will Quince resigning that you said we'd never get any further use out of? Let's have that again, but with the producer sighing vegan sausage over every Will Quince.
No. Vegan sausage. No. Vegan sausage.
We go on.
This is shape. Vegan sausage. Vegan sausage.
Everything.
What are we going to do?
Surely not.
We learned that the meat-free banger had been interpreted by a voluble sector of Cracker Barrel's customer base and or angry morons on the internet as something between an affront and a heresy, on par with compelling all patrons prior to ploughing into their bacon and egg hash brown casserole, an actual Cracker Barrel menu item, we do our research, submit to a gay wedding and a chorus of the red flag. Was that really the red flag with a high-energy beat underneath it? More champagne sound effects. Anyway, we learned that loads of people were, as a consequence of the vegan sausage, which, to reiterate, will just be there as an option, no one's going to make you eat it, vowing to boycott Cracker Barrel from here on. We also learned, or at any rate imagined, that some indeed are planning instead to import German sausage in bulk in big crates, which is very much a worst case scenario. And we learned, though to be honest, should as a species have figured this out already, that climbing into zoo enclosures is an unclever idea. And we learned further that it may be unclever for reasons even beyond the obvious ones of getting bitten, arrested, and deservedly ridiculed for the rest of one's mortal allotment by one's fellow citizens. We learned that such misadventures also incur the risk of herpes. We learned this thanks to a miscreant, if not indeed an outright scofflaw, who climbed into the snow monkey enclosure of Tasmania Zoo in the settlement of Launceston. We learned from subsequent statements from the zoo that the monkeys are absolutely riddled with herpes, of a variety which doesn't bother monkeys over much, but may be actually fatal in humans.
Oh no.
And we learned that contagious macaques may be the least of Launceston's problems, as we learned that the enclosure clamberer had undertaken his raid in a bid to retrieve coins flung into the monkey's pond by zoo patrons. So we learned that Launcestonians have yet to learn that monkeys will basically just do monkey stuff for free, because they're monkeys. And we learned how incredibly annoying it is that Tasmania Zoo is in Launceston, not Devonport, because then we could have faded out on this song with an absolutely fantastic joke about monkey gone to Devonport, but you can't win every week. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24, and last, but by no means least, on today's show, it is time for a roundup of film news, and I am joined for exactly that in the studio by the film critic Karen Krasanovic. Karen, welcome back to The Briefing.
Lovely to be here.
With what are we starting?
Well, I wanted to talk about Ezra Miller, because he's getting himself into a lot of trouble. 29-year-old, you may have remembered him in We Need to Talk About Kevin, has a movie that he's starred in, plays several duplicate roles, and he's causing a real storm for Warner's and Warner's Discovery, which is the new parent channel. He has done some erratic behavior in Vermont, and he's said that his mother has said that he will seek professional help. But he's also gotten into a lot of trouble in Hawaii. Now, why is this news? Because
that was my next question.
Sorry, Warner's is not scrapping this film. The budget is reportedly $200 million, and they don't. They've got three scenarios about how they're going to handle it. But the worse he acts, I don't know. You could say there's no such thing as bad publicity, but how many people are going to want to watch him?
When we talk about erratic behavior, what definition of erratic are we working off here?
Well, he received a felony burglary charge, and apparently he stole some liquor from a house. Which I didn't know was a felony, but I guess I know now.
Because the thing is, in general, with showbiz types, there's erratic behavior and there's erratic behavior. And people are fairly indulgent, usually, of the kind of erratic behavior which comes across as just sort of somewhat reckless, overindulged, general bacchanalia / wassailing. Whereas this sort of seems just a bit, no convictions have as yet been recorded. This just seems just a bit crimey.
It's a little crimey. It's also quite indulgent, I think, because he knows that he's got Warner Brothers on the hook. He also knows that they can't really do this movie without him. And so, for example, in Hawaii a few months ago, he threw a chair at a woman and hit her in the forehead because she asked him to leave the party. And so he's been in a lot of kind of naughty trouble. That would we forgive James Dean or Robert Mitchum? No, I don't think we would. And he seems to be doing again and again and again. So they're either going to scrap the movie, which is going to cost them a lot of... Now, don't forget, this is the same studio that scrapped Batgirl, which was half of the budget. They're not going to involve him with any sort of publicity, possibly, or they're basically just going to sort of shuffle it out and not really deal with it.
Well, moving seamlessly along on the subject of people who don't think someone can make a movie without them, I think I landed that one. Neve Campbell is not going to participate. It says here in, I don't know, how many screams are we up to now? She's not on board for Scream 97.
Six.
Five, six, 97, yeah, because she's not getting paid enough.
No, that's a 10 out of 10 there.
Okay.
You did a good job.
But what I'm going to go ahead and guess is that when we talk about Neve Campbell and what she regards as not enough, this is going to be an extremely relative concept, isn't it?
Well, it is going to be relative because she's talking about if she was a man, she would probably be paid more, which I think is probably
she
true.
She probably has a good point
yes,
there.
Yes, yes. Now, for number four, the reported pay for her was $10 million. Now, that was two movies ago or one movie ago. And that installment made $140 million at the box office. So she is looking at something probably double that, I would assume, or at least something, a nice gesture. But I think what's going to happen here is she's been in all five of the films. They're making six with some new directors. And I think it looks like they're trying to do a little, oh, we have to reboot because Neve won't play ball. I think that's what's going on, which happens a lot to people who are involved. I mean, thinking, you know, Ezra Miller could do the same thing. Say, I'm not going to do it if you're not going to pay me this. And they go, that's a shame. Okay, we've got somebody else lined up.
These cases are a bit weird because on the one hand, she does have a point, which I'm sure is the case, that, you know, leading female actors are paid relatively less than leading male actors. But on the other hand, you do rather struggle for sympathy when you're knocking back $10 million for, I'm guessing, a few months' work.
Well, yes, but it's also, she's very central. She's been in all of the movies. Mm. Now, if you compare her, let's say, Jamie Lee Curtis, I mean, that's kind of almost the same stature. So, I mean, as far as the franchise goes. So I think she's got a point. She's been talking about this to People magazine, but she was actually talking about a Red Cross charity that she was involved with. So she hasn't been just bellowing this. This is sort of part of another interview. So I think she's playing for all she's worth. She values herself. And if that means she's not in Scream, then so be it. She's free for something else.
Well, let's move along to Jordan Peele's Nope, which is currently shifting a great many tickets at the box office.
Doing
and is
well.
A film which I have not seen, but you have, and I believe you liked.
I've seen it twice. Yeah, I really, really like it. Now, you don't have to like his previous movies, Us or Them. This stars Daniel Kaluuya, Kiki Palmer, Stephen Ewan, Michael Wincott as an irascible cinematographer, and Brandon Perea. I keep mixing him up with another actor, which is a shame, but they've been great energy. And what they're saying is that Nope does for the sky what Jaws does for the sea. I did not know it was a UFO film. This is a spoiler.
What, as it makes you not want to go in it?
Yes, it makes you very aware of what could be up there and what you don't see. So it's a tremendous film. There's a lot packed into it. There's a lot of black cinematic history, which is painlessly delivered. It's not on the nose. What I'm saying, he's not making this big, big point. It's part of the story, exploitation of the film industry. But also, Daniel Kaluuya plays this very introverted, really hardly speaks character who's the linchpin of the whole thing. And he's tremendous. The cinematography, and particularly the sound, Andrew, you'd like this, uses a full orchestra with real instruments along with sound effects. It sounds great.
Well, we should speak finally about a subject which I know we have talked about on shows earlier this week, and which a lot of the entertainment media has been talking about this week, and quite rightly. This is the death of Olivia Newton-John at the age of 73. Obviously, in terms of cinema, the thing everybody thinks about is her role of Sandy Olsen in Grease. But how big, where does Grease rank now in the cinematic pantheon, do you think? It is one of those films that nobody seems to have any meaningful objections to, despite it being a musical.
Yeah, it's fun. It's set in a period. It's period setting. It's got some great actors in it. I mean, she and John Travolta, and also Stockard Channing. It's snappy, and it's got catchy songs. So that's everything you need for a hit musical. It's been going. It was also based on a very successful stage play, stage musical. So that's another thing. We've already got a fan base there. But as far as I think it's iconic. There hasn't been another movie like it, although plenty have tried. And she was part of the appeal, that wonderful pairing of Travolta
well,
and her.
The thing I was going to ask, it is also, I mean, casting is always one of those parallel universe things, as in what if actor X had played this role instead of actor Y. But yes. How crucial to, especially the enduring success of Grease, do you think it is that Olivia Newton-John played that role as opposed to literally anybody else who might have? I mean, I can remember from my own perspective as an Australian, it was seen as a massive whoop in Australia that this Australian accented person was appearing in this massive Hollywood hit. That didn't happen all that often at the time.
No, it did not at the time. And also, it still doesn't happen where she's allowed to do her own accent. Well, who was actually considered for the role was the producer, Alan Carr, said he considered Carrie Fisher, Deborah Raffin, Susan Day, and Mary Osmond were all considered for this role, when actually at a dinner party hosted by Helen Reddy, he met Newton-John, and John Travolta also said, "We've got to have her. She'll be perfect."
Because Helen Reddy, the Australian mafia in full effect.
There you go. I'm sure there's a term for it. As in Wales, they call it the taffia. I'm sure they'll call it something here. But that's where she got the gig. And also, she looked amazing, and she had a very wholesome quality about her, which, of course, the camera can see.
Karen Krasanovich, thank you as always for joining us. If you want to hear more about Jordan Peele's Nope, tune into the next episode of Monocle on Culture on Monday, August 15th for a full review of the film. That is this coming Monday. It flies when you're having fun. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello. Our researcher was Tamsin Howard, and our studio manager was Nora Huell. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time. I'll be your host for that as well. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.